Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to a very special two-hour episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we pay tribute to one of the most legendary actors of our time, Al Pacino, with special guests Thomas G. Waits, Pacino's co-star on the stage in Richard III and American Buffalo, and on the screen in And Justice for All. From the motion picture phenomenon Scarface, actor Stephen Bauer. From Pacino's latest directorial effort, Salamaybe, actors Steve Roman, Joe Rossetto, Pancho Hodges, Corey Lee Loisel, and Jeffrey Owens. Acclaimed director of early Pacino films, The Panic in Needle Park and Scarecrow, Jerry Schatzberg. Author of the book, The Films of Al Pacino, William Scholl. And a special bonus interview with Pacino's Looking for Richard and Cruising co-star, Richard Cox, for our archive listeners. Let's get this celebration started. Here are your beloved movie geeks, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Very excited tonight to be bringing you this two-hour special tribute to a man we all admire so much, Mr. Al Pacino. I know there are a ton of you out there that have been with us from the very beginning, and we appreciate you listening in tonight and continuing to support us and plugging our show on all of your blogs and bulletins. Thank you so much. And for all of the new listeners out there, I know there's probably quite a few of you out there tonight. Thank you and welcome. Let us introduce ourselves to you, the Movie Geek team. My name is Jamie.
I'm Jerry.
And I'm Chris.
Yes. It's just like the Waltons or something. Very nice. Just to let everyone know, we're going to have a bunch of guests on tonight. The switchboard's going to be lit up all night, so if you could hold your calls, that would be greatly appreciated. But if you have questions, we'll be checking our email throughout each interview, and you can reach us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. Submit your questions. We'll do our best to get them asked and answered for you. Just make sure you include your name with the correspondence so we can give you a little plug on air. You guys all set to get this thing started?
Yes.
Okay. We begin our celebration with a discussion on Pacino's first love, the theater. Pacino has returned to his roots in the theater consistently throughout his film career, turning in some of his most striking and potent performances in productions as diverse as Eugene O'Neill's Huey, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Ira Lewis's Chinese Coffee, and Dennis McIntyre's National Anthem, just to name a few. In fact, before entering the world of film, Pacino won an Obie Award for Best Supporting Actor in 1968 for his performance in The Indian Wants the Bronx, a Best Supporting Actor Tony Award in 1969 for Does a Tiger Wear a Necktie, and finally a Best Actor Tony in 1977 for David Rabe's The Basic Training of Pavlo Hummel. Our first guest this evening, Thomas G. Waits, has worked on stage with Pacino on three occasions, in 1979's Broadway production of Richard III, and in 1980 and 1982 with a highly acclaimed production of David Mamet's American Buffalo. Mr. Waits also appeared with Pacino as Jeff McCullough in Norman Jewison's And Justice for All. He is an esteemed member of the Actors Studio and a Juilliard graduate. His resume is littered with many extraordinary films and performances, including The Warriors, John Carpenter's The Thing, Light of Day, State of Grace, Born on the 4th of July, and Money Train. His highly prolific television career includes roles in Miami Vice, NYPD Blue, Oz, Law and Order, and many others. In addition to his film and television work, he also owns and operates his own tremendously successful acting studio in New York City. Al Pacino has called him a great actor with a beautiful talent, and it is our pleasure to welcome to the show actor, playwright, director, and teacher, Mr. Thomas G. Waits. Mr. Waits.
Hi.
Thanks
for the introduction.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it so much.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Now, how long had you been working professionally before you fell into the collaboration with Pacino and Richard III?
Well, it happened pretty early on for me. I was very fortunate. I first met Al when he was originally going to do Born on the 4th of July. You know, before Tom Cruise did it, Al was supposed to do it with Oliver Stone directing and a director by the name of Daniel Petrie.
Right.
And I was auditioning for a character in that. I think the character's name was Tim. And I went in to the office to audition, and I auditioned with him, you know, and there I was, you know, just out of acting school, and the great Al Pacino sitting across from me, and I just, I was paralyzed with, you know, like awe.
I bet.
And yet he was so gracious and so humble, and he worked with me, and we did the scene, and they ended up shelving the project for the time being, and then they did Injustice for All instead, and they brought me in for that. I got that, and I went down, and I worked with Al in Baltimore. And then a few months later, they called me to come in and audition for Richard III, and that was the beginning of my relationship with him.
Oh, great. Well, the production of Richard III actually took place, you know, the absolute height of his fame. This was 1979 when he'd already done Godfather films and Dog Day and Serpico. It seems kind of to happen more often nowadays for American actors of his stature to return to the stage, but was this uncommon during that period of time in the 70s?
Well, I think it was uncommon for him to do Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was the anomaly. It was that, you know, all of a sudden this, you know, known great actor had the courage, screwed up the courage to go out and attack a role like Richard III. And, you know, it was a tremendously challenging production, but ultimately very successful. And I'll tell you an interesting story about that is the day I was leaving Richard III, I went down to his dressing room to say goodbye, and I put a copy of American Buffalo on his dressing table, and I said, you know, I think you should do this play. And, you know, he hardly knew me, really. I mean, we sort of knew each other, but we'd worked together, and, you know, he always liked me. He was always very good to me. And he just stared at the script like, who is this kid putting this script on my dressing table? And then sure enough, about 6 months later, they called me to go over to his apartment to do a read-through of it. And then we read through it, and then I didn't hear anything, which is very common in this business. You know, you do things, and then you don't hear anything for a long time, and you think, well, that's never going to happen, you know.
Right.
And then I was in Cleveland doing Shakespeare for the summer, and they called me, and they said, well, they want you to come and audition for American Buffalo. So, and every wonderful actor of the time, still wonderful actors, Matt Dillon, one of my favorite actors, a lot of guys were up for the part, and, you know, fortune fell my way, and I got the part. Elliot Martin was the producer, an excellent top-shelf elite producer. Arvin Brown directed it. Cliff James was Donnie, and we brought magic to the stage, you know, especially Al.
Wow. Yeah, he seems tailor-made for Mamet. And I want to get to the Buffalo production in just a second, but I understand that during the rehearsal process for Richard III, he was endless in his attempts to try new things with the character. What was new and fresh about his portrayal of Richard III?
Well, the thing about Al is, you know, he's extremely resourceful. He's a very capable guy, you know. If something isn't working, he's first trying to figure it out. You know, he never gives up. He's as tenacious as a bulldog with a bone in its mouth. He just does not give up. And, you know, that's one of the things that all young actors can learn from him is his tenacity, which is, I think, served him very well. And, you know, Shakespeare is a formidable task for anyone.
Right.
And, you know, with a stellar reputation like his, it takes a lot of guts to get out there and try something that you may fail in. But that's one of the things that makes him great, one of the many things that makes him great. I'm personally most fond of his generosity. He's an extremely generous man, you know. When you're working with him, oftentimes he has people over to his house, and he has these beautiful catered meals, and you go out and play touch football. And, you know, he's just an extremely generous human being.
Yeah.
And most people don't know that about him, you know, because they don't get the opportunity to work with him. But he's very generous and extremely sensitive man.
I've read that time and again, and we even heard from Richard Cox on Friday's show. And
love Richard.
Yeah, and he spoke to how completely helpful Pacino was, even off camera.
Absolutely.
Helping him with the scenes.
Absolutely.
I know that you teach Shakespeare quite extensively.
Yep.
And part of what I found so fascinating about Pacino's film Looking for Richard was that you saw the struggle. You saw the struggle that he went through just to understand what was trying to be expressed in those words.
Mm-hmm.
In your estimation, How do you break through your prejudices of Shakespeare and make the language your own? Is there a key secret to that, or is that a loaded question?
Well, I think you study it. You know, I think you study it. I think you study the great ones that have done it before, and I think you stare at the page, and I think the words speak to you. You know, Shakespeare was, if people don't know, and still is, the greatest writer to have ever lived.
Yeah.
You know, every author, every novelist, every poet tips his hat and bows down to Shakespeare, because he wasn't just a great playwright, he was a great philosopher, a great poet, a great comedian, a great tragedian. He could do it all. You know, and all you have to do is listen, really. That's the key to Shakespeare, is listen. And he'll teach you. If you speak the words properly, the acting takes care of itself.
Absolutely. So how did the Buffalo production compare to the Richard III production?
Well, American Buffalo was hugely successful. I mean, I'll never forget it as long as I live. The day the box office opened on Bleecker Street, the line was out to 6th Avenue. I mean, Al came into rehearsal and looked at us, and he was like, "Did you see that line?" I'm like, "Yeah, this is great." You know, I mean, believe me, I've been in plays where one person has shown up in the audience. And when you work with Al, of course, you don't have to worry about that because people come.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a very intensive process. There's only three characters on stage the whole time, and it's Mamet, you know, the genius of David Mamet, the man who has taken language to another level. I mean, obviously a great playwright in his own right. And Al is, you know, he's a taskmaster. And by that I mean, you know, even after you're performing the play for a long time, he insists on rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just keep rehearsing the thing, no matter what. It doesn't matter. Every other play you do, once it opens for the critics, that's basically it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to rehearse anymore, you know. They come in, they do the job, and that's it.
Yeah.
But not Al. You know, he's always hungry for the truth, for more truth, deeper truths. You know, deeper truth. He's always searching. And he inculcates that sense of discipline in people, you know. It was a very successful production. I mean, it was amazing. Every night to play to sold out houses.
Yeah,
wonderful. You know,
I've read of Pacino. I think he might have said this himself, that if he could only rehearse, be in rehearsal for a play and not have to worry about performance, that would make him very happy.
Yeah, much to the chagrin of producers.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Although Elliot Martin is a great producer, he's one of the last producers of the old school where they really nurture and develop. Like, we did American Buffalo in New Haven first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we developed it slowly, carefully. We took our time with it. He gave us the time. He gave us a very lengthy preview process before we opened for the critics. You know, nowadays a lot of producers, you know, they're in a hurry.
Yeah.
You know, and if you want to make something great, you can't be in a hurry.
Yeah, that's very rare to kind of nurture that process like that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Is this true that I read that David Mamet actually has been known to sit in the house and stop a performance if his dialogue isn't correctly spoken word for word? Is that just folklore?
Not in our production. He just sat there with an unlit cigar in his mouth and seemed to be enjoying himself. His lines are very difficult to learn.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very complicated poetical pattern that it follows, but if you throw in one extra syllable, it throws the whole scheme of the thing off.
It throws it off, yeah.
You got to be really specific.
I know that Pacino has said that it is challenging, but once you break through Mamet's dialogue and find that rhythm, it's fairly, as he called it, actor-proof. Do you agree with that?
Totally, just like with Shakespeare.
Yeah.
You know, the great playwrights know how to do that. They know how to make it so that it's pretty hard to mess it up. You know, if you just say what they want and mean what they say when they want it, then pretty much you'll be okay if you're listening.
Yeah.
You know, but no, Dave was great. I mean, he came to her, he was so happy. I mean, you know, this made him a very, he was already known, but this made him a very, you know, successful man as a playwright out doing his play. And no, he followed protocol, and the protocol in the theater is the playwright, if he has notes, goes to the director.
Mm-hmm.
The playwright doesn't speak to the actors except to say, you know, good job or good show.
Right.
The protocol is that the playwright goes to the director goes to the actor. So if he ever had any notes, they came through Arvin Brown in that case.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Injustice for All, and you give just a heartbreaking performance in that film. And you've talked about how the role came about for you, but what was the experience like working with Pacino in those scenes? Was the process different from, obviously, did you have rehearsal at all for that film?
Yeah, we did. We had 2 weeks of rehearsal, you know, and Lee Strasberg was there. And, you know, we sat around the table, and Norman Jewison, another old school director, really takes his time. And then, you know, we got down there to shoot, you know, the scenes, and early on I had to do that big emotional scene, and I was terrified. Okay, I mean, here I am with one of my heroes. I mean, I became Michael Corleone after I saw The Godfather. You know, I walked around and I thought I was him. And there I am sitting in a room with him, and there I'm shooting a scene with him, and I wasn't doing very well. You know, I knew all my lines, but I wasn't in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And Al knew that, and Norman knew that, and they were like, okay, everybody out of the room. They cleared the set, and Al said, let's just read it, you know, like we've never seen it before.
Right.
So, like, he gave you that comfort zone, you know, to sit down and just go back to basics and just read the script, and then I was able to relax. And I looked at him, and I said, Al, I'm really confused. And he said, that's a good state of mind for an actor to be.
Norman Jewison directed that film, is he?
Yeah, Norman, terrific director.
He seems like a real actor's director. What kind of set does he maintain?
He's got a firm grip. He's got a firm grip on the set. You know, directing movies, you know, I've only done one very short film, and I don't know if anyone will ever see it, but running a movie set is a whole different. Walter Hill was an excellent director as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're guys that they have the command of this operation, but yet they're almost invisible.
Right.
And it's somehow they manage to walk that line of being both in total control and yet you don't even know they're there.
Mm.
And Norman was great with the actors because he would take you off to the side and speak to you, probably the way Kazan used to do with his actors.
Wow.
Very, very personally. You know, like, how you doing? You know, are you okay? Are you relaxed? Do you need anything? Do you want some coffee? You need something to eat? Are you all right? Yeah, I'm okay. You know, I'm nervous. You know, I'm a young kid, and I'm trying to make my bones. I'm trying to cut my teeth, and here I am with Al Pacino. You know, it's a heightened situation.
Oh, yeah.
But it was great. And, you know, Al's been very good to me over the years. A couple of times I've contacted him for a letter of recommendation for a teaching job I might be applying for. Or, you know, and he recommended me for a play on Broadway at one point in my career. I did Awake and Sing on Broadway, and the conversation was apparently the director said, I got to find a kid to play, you know, the John Garfield part.
Right.
Mm.
And Al said, well, what about Tommy Waits? And he said, no, he's too old. I was 29 at the time, and the character is 23. And Al's like, yeah, but he's got this. He's got the stuff to do it. He's got the real stuff to do it.
Oh, wow.
So the story goes that they hired someone else, and the guy who they hired, whose name I can't remember, took a swing at the director first day of rehearsal. So they said, let's get Waits.
So
I got the job. I opened to sensational reviews, and then I got a movie from it. And it was all because, you know, Al, I mean, he's got that kind of power, obviously, but he's very judicious. You know, he's not going to go around recommending people for things if they're not right for it.
Mm-hmm.
He's a man of integrity. You know, he's not going to say things he doesn't mean. He's not going to mean things he doesn't say.
Yeah.
You know, but he's just a great guy. And he's also, of course, one of the members of the Actors Studio where I work out of. And you know, and I have an acting school, the Thomas G. Waits Acting Studio. You can go to thomasgwaits.com, one word, thomasgwaits.com, and you can see, you know, everything about the school.
Yeah, I want you to tell us just a little bit about your acting school before you go.
It's really good. You know, it's a good thing. We have about, you know, 30 students all together. We work out two times a week. We do a couple of shows every year, and we combine the method approach with the classical approach.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a really good thing. You know, it's a great way to keep your pencil sharp, and I've helped a lot of people, succeed. And you know, it's a tough industry to break into, but if you know what you're doing, you know, if you have your craft honed and your pencils are sharp, well, you have a better chance of going in there and making that impression on people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have the link up for your acting school. It's on our show notes on our Blog Talk Radio page and in our Movie Geeks United blog as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been an honor to have
you.
Hey,
I really appreciate it. And I understand you're interviewing Steve Bauer. He was terrific in Scarface.
Yes, he was.
Well, we're really geeking out.
Terrific actor also.
Yes.
So make sure you give them my best, okay?
Thank you so much.
Will do. Thank you.
Okay, gentlemen.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thomas G. Waits, frequent co-star of Pacino on stage and screen and owner of Thomas G. Waits Acting School in New York City. Great guest.
Yeah. If I may just add, I think what I've learned with the last two interviews we've done with Richard Cox and Mr. Waits is Pacino is an incredibly nurturing spirit on the set and off the set.
Yeah. And I think that's obviously the sign of a good human being, but also a good artist. Because to be that giving, I think that's very important, because it elevates the quality of everyone's work.
Yes, it does.
You know, to be that generous. I think we're probably going to hear a lot more of that kind of sentiment tonight from all of our guests. Stephen Bauer will be calling in any minute now, and we'll bring him on. Also in the show, we have five cast members from Salo Maybe, which is the latest directorial project for Pacino. It's one of his passion projects that really hasn't been discussed before. So we're going to give you the scoop on that. And also director Jerry Schatzberg, who directed Pacino before The Godfather came around in The Panic in Needle Park, which you just rewatched again last night, right, Jerry?
Yes, I did. Yes.
What were your impressions when you watched it again?
Well, there are a couple of impressions actually. The first one I bring up is he co-stars with Richard Bright in the film, who is a famous character actor from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and into this century before he passed away. But they had a great chemistry on screen that would follow in the Godfather films. But the other thing I noticed is that Pacino brings a lot of his stage work into this first major role, and you can't help but think that he brings a lot of the same energy and intensity that Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole brought into their first roles from the stage as well. So it was just really magnificent to watch again with that kind of hindsight.
You know, and I think I enjoy his theatricality, and I know there's some criticisms for that as of late, but you know, the voice and that kind of thing that he gets criticized for a lot lately. But I really appreciate the theatrical kind of sense that he brings to some of these performances. You know, how else would you want, I've made this point before, how else would you want to see the devil played?
Exactly.
How else do you play Colonel Frank Slade? These are roles that demand that kind of power and theatrical sense.
I agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jamie, you and I actually were talking about his stage work, and you and I got the chance to actually see him on stage, you know, for Huey. And it's kind of, I hope people out there get a chance to see him on stage, because when you talk about his theatricality and his energy, in movies sometimes it might feel strange, but on the stage it's intense.
Yes.
And it's so intense that you realize, you know, what a great actor he is and what he's bringing to every piece of work he does. You can't look away from him on stage.
Absolutely. He is a true artist, because he continuously returns to the stage. Even in the past 2 years, he's been back on the stage to do Arturo Breck's play. He's just a consummate actor, and that was a great experience seeing him. You and I traveled especially to L.A. to see him in that performance of Yui in 1999, and I was fortunate enough to be invited backstage.
Oh, you have to rub that in, don't you?
I just have to throw that out. But you got to shake hands with him and meet him as well, and it's true. Even with his public now, he's so gracious and humble. And when I met him, of course, my mind was racing. I was thinking, oh my God, I'm standing in front of Tony Montana and Michael Corleone, and it was very intimidating. But the second he shook my hand, and I could almost see that he was just as nervous as I was, if you believe that, it just automatically set me at ease. It's just this aura he has that it's just something quite special.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, but Yui was a fantastic production. But anyway, back to, as we're waiting for Mr. Bauer to call in, back to Jerry Schatzberg, in addition to Panic in Needle Park, he also directed 1973's Scarecrow, which is one of the absolute gems of 70s filmmaking for me. It was Al Pacino and Gene Hackman. They played two hobos that struck up an unlikely friendship. And that's a stunning movie, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And plus, to see Pacino and Hackman together for the first and only time, it's just a major treat. And that both of those movies are available now on DVD, so I would highly recommend picking those up, as well as the DVD box set of Pacino's passion projects, Looking for Richard, Chinese Coffee, and The Local Stigmatic. And Jerry, you just got a chance. You just had a chance to watch Chinese Coffee and Local Stigmatic. What did you think?
I think for me, The Local Stigmatic, because it's been part of this folklore, Al Pacino folklore, I guess since 1989, since I read this interview in Vanity Fair when Sea of Love came out, and he kept talking about what he's been working on because it had been 4 or 5 years since Revolution,
right.
And he keeps talking about this like movie that he basically is in possession of that he'll show a couple of friends, and for any Pacino fan or any movie fan, really, it is worth your time to see, because this is a Pacino you do not get to see in the movies. This
right.
is a different Pacino, and it's really worth your time, and especially the DVD, because it comes with a great prologue and epilogue where he's interviewed, and it really helps you get a feel for the movie.
Right.
But it's about 58 minutes. And it's unlike anything you think. When you were talking earlier about who, like, say he just, his theatrics are over the top.
Right.
I think if they watch this, they'll definitely have a different opinion and
right.
maybe respect that more.
Yeah, 58. That's The Local Stigmatic. Correct?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing work. And if you want an insight into his artistry, on a level that you don't necessarily find from his other films, these passion projects are essential. It's called Al Pacino, An Actor's Vision. It's a 4-DVD box set, and it's available starting this week. And gentlemen, we're very excited. The moment has arrived.
All right.
Our next guest is here. We move now from stage to screen. Our next guest studied acting under the famed teacher Stella Adler, and has since appeared in a roster of terrific films that include Running Scared, Raising Kane, Primal Fear, Masked and Anonymous, The Lost City, and Traffic, for which he shared the Outstanding Cast Performance Honor at the 2001 Screen Actors Guild Awards. But it's his immortal portrayal of Manny in Brian De Palma's Scarface that has forever endeared him in the hearts of film lovers all over the world. His performance in Scarface earned him a Golden Globe nomination for Best Supporting Actor. And 24 years after the film's initial release, Scarface is hotter than ever, having entered the stratosphere of pop culture, thanks in large part to Bauer's vividly realized and unforgettable contribution. We are privileged tonight to welcome to the show this wonderful actor, Mr. Stephen Bauer. Stephen, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm right.
Hey.
Hi.
Thank you
How
so
are you
much
guys?
For calling in.
Wow, that's so great that you're doing this.
Thank you. Yeah, Pacino is definitely an idol of all of ours.
Yes.
We're having a really great time paying tribute to him tonight. At what point did you study with Stella Adler?
Actually, I was with Stella. I met her in the summer of 81, actually. And Melanie Griffith and I were, when we were first together, we both we knew about Stella Adler, and we were told by a good friend that she had a great class in the summers in Los Angeles, and she went out to L.A. in the summers, and mostly taught in New York, of course.
Yeah.
And she did a class called script analysis, and so we joined, we signed up for it, and we're just knocked out by her vision and her style, her expression, and
what were some of the main things that you took from her?
Well, she was just so passionate, and she knew human behavior, and she had seen so much. You know, one of the things that was so great about her is that it's just her lifespan and her experience. She was in the theater, and she lived in the theater. She was raised in the theater. Her father, Jacob Adler, was the last great actor of the Yiddish theater in New York, and she worked as a kid, as a young girl, with her dad in the Yiddish theater, and then went on to the American stage, and then forming the group theater with her husband, with Harold Clareman and Lee Strasberg, and then she went to Russia and studied with Stanislavski at his bedside when he was dying.
Wow, what a life.
Yeah, so she brought back her version of the Stanislavski method, and that's where she had the big break with Lee Strasberg. Mm. But anyway, she had her own thing to teach, and she was just very passionate. It's one of the things that she just, she would take you apart, but she inspired you too. She was very inspirational, and she always brought it back to the history of the character and the homework, and also the art of the literature itself. She,
right.
She was very much a believer in the literature of the stage and respecting the author's intentions. So we learned a lot, and needless to say, I did my first audition for her, and she stopped me. I was doing Mark Anthony from Julius Caesar, and she stopped me. And she said, "You must come to New York and study with me."
Oh wow!
I said, "Okay, all right, okay." So we were off to New York City the following fall, and we spent a year studying with her.
Mm.
Wow!
And after that year was where I got the call for the first meeting for Scarface.
Yeah. I understand that audition process was fairly long-winded and arduous, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. It really went on for a long time. I remember that we started in the spring, and just before the summer of 82, I believe. And then it wasn't settled till about August or September, I think.
Mm. Wow.
Do you remember the first time you met Al?
Yes, actually, the first time I met Al was this is really ironic, because I met him. I don't know if he remembers this, but I met him at a cafe in the Village. After seeing him, some friends took me to see him in Buffalo, in American Buffalo, and I think I sat like in the fourth row or something, and I was just knocked out, right? And then but after the show, we got invited to go to this cafe. To this bar or something, and we sat at a big table, a lot of people, and I sat on a corner, and he sat at the head of the table. So I sat literally inches from him. I don't think I said a word to him, but that must have been in the spring, it must have been the spring or in the winter of 82. And then right after that was the audition, the first audition. And then, ironically, I started the auditioning process and the meetings with Brian De Palma and then Martin Bregman in L.A., Marty Bregman in Los Angeles, and he gave me the script, and I started, reading the script and learning the part and preparing to meet Al, because the whole deal was, well, we can't, we, you know, you'll be our, you're our choice, but, you know, Al's going to make, you know, he's got to come on board,
decision, yeah.
You know, he's got to meet you. But I couldn't meet Al for, you know, God knows, the whole summer went by, and I still hadn't met Al. And then finally they put us together in a room, and it was I like to call it love at first sight. It was chemistry, you know, and you're like, when you meet the girl, you know, and it's like, oh boy, it was like firework. It just, you know, we just like hit it off immediately. So it was kind of, that was really the first time we met, because, like I said, I mean, I sat inches from him, but I don't think I talked to him all night.
Yeah. I understand that you and Al were pretty inseparable during the shoot.
Yeah, during the shoot.
What kind of things did he take from you and vice versa?
Well, the thing is that I really felt, you know, I really felt that what I could offer mostly was the reality of my experience, of my being Cuban, of my growing up with that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that if I could bring some of that to the movie, if that could seep, you know, if I could infuse that in some of the other actors who weren't, the ones who weren't Cuban, that would be a major, major moral triumph for me, you know, and for my, and for where I came from.
Right.
Well, you succeeded.
Yeah. I wanted it to have some authenticity, because it not only was it my first step into movie, you know, into movies, really, it was my first movie, my first film. I mean, I'd been doing some television, but I really didn't want to enter film, the world of cinema, without it being some sort of, you know, something meaningful, and it was luck that it turned out to be Scarface. It turned out to be this kind of break, obviously opposite him. So when I, and again, and in something that had to do with my culture, and my culture being so weird, you know, to the United States, you know, I grew up as a foreigner, you know, really I was an outsider in the United States, and I was, it imbued everything that I was, all my upbringing, you know, being an outsider, you know, as a kid. Luckily I didn't, you know, I'm not saying poor me, because there are many who had it much rougher than I did. Because I didn't really look like an outsider. I didn't look that. I don't have, you know, I didn't have, like, as a kid, I had lighter hair. I'm like, you know, and I didn't really look like that little Latin kid, you know. So I wasn't picked on that way. But I did have, like, this big name. My dad's name, my dad's family name is Echevarria. And so I did carry, like, this big-ass, long Latin name that nobody could pronounce. And that was a source of tremendous consternation for me in school, because I didn't even want to identify myself. So I was invisible, really, as a kid. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't outgoing. So when I became an actor, when I had the opportunity to do Scarface, I thought, man, if this movie, I mean, it's about Cubans. Finally, I can, like, redeem Cubans in the eyes of, you know, not only, you know, the U.S., but the world, probably. And Bregman, I remember Bregman had told me early on, because there was this possibility that I was going to do, I got an offer to do another film about the same time, right at the same time, and it would have conflicted.
Mm.
And it was a great opportunity. It was a nice film, it was a Canadian film, and it was the lead role. And there were, you know, a lot of people wanted me to do it, because it would have been a break. But I was on hold for Al to, you know, to the big meeting with Al.
Right.
Like that, I had Scarface, but I didn't have it yet. You know, it's like a bird in hand, right? So I had this other film, this Canadian film, and everybody's like, "You're crazy, Stephen. You're an idiot. Take the film that's real," you know. And other people were telling everybody was saying, "You're not gonna get Scarface. You're deluding yourself." And I said, "No, but," and I'm like, you know, I'd be like the good boy. I'd be like, "No, but Mr. Bregman said," Mr. Bregman told me, "I'm going to do Scarface. I just have to meet Al." And they'd be like, "Yes, sure. Yeah, right. Oh, what? You're going to believe Mr. Hollywood producer."
Yeah.
and you're going to turn down an opportunity like this to star in this great little movie. And I said, yeah. And then, so when push came to shove, and I went, I went to Bregman again, and like one more time. I went to him like 10 times, and I said, please, they're begging me. Can I give them some sort of, like, you know, insurance that I'm not crazy for turning down this other film? And he said, I just want you to think about it, something. He's got a really deep voice. He goes, I want you to remember this. That movie, that little movie, at the most, it's going to be seen by maybe a few thousand people. Maybe. Maybe. How many people do you think will see Scarface? He said, just think about that. Scarface.
I think it's very safe to say you made the right choice.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah. So I turned on the other movie.
There's probably a few thousand people watching Scarface right this moment.
Yeah.
Hey, you know where I am right now? I'm actually parked. I'm parked on the street on Washington, in Miami Beach, on Washington Avenue, you know?
Yeah.
And right by where those shops are that sell the posters and those big ass frame, like, Scarface kits.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the action figures, I bet, too.
I walk by here, like, when I'm here, when I'm in Miami, I walk down this street, and, like, there's these stores that sell Scarface stuff that's, like, unlicensed Scarface memorabilia, you know, and there we are, like, right in the picture window. And every once in a while, like, a friend of mine will, like, beg me, like, to walk into one of the stores because he'll want to buy something for a, you know, like a friend of mine will want to buy a gift for another of his, like, Scarface buddies. And so we go in there and choose the thing, and then I sign it, and then I'll sign a few more for the guy in the store. The store guy will freak. I'll be like, oh, my God, I can't believe you just, like, made this, like, so valuable, you know, coming in and signing it and stuff.
Oh, wow. Well, actually, Jerry, you had a question about the original Scarface.
I have a question for you, Mr. Bauer. I first of all, think that your performance of Manny is, like, one of the great things in the remake. It just really, you're the best friend that anyone would want in that world.
Yeah.
I mean, you're, like, the most human character in the whole film.
Well, thank
and,
you. Thank you.
I mean, it's the one thing I think you actually transcend George Raft's role in the original. I think you actually, because it's more fleshed out, it's a fully realized vision in the Brian De Palma version. But I was curious, because as I've been researching, it turns out that Pacino was initially intimidated about taking on a role that Paul Muni had immortalized at the time. How did you feel about taking on George Raft's part? Was there any sort of intimidation or...
Honestly, this is what I can say about that is that although we thought a lot together, you know, like a communally thought about the original. Once we had that screenplay by Oliver Stone, it had a life and a flavor of its own. Guys, the thing is that it was so modern, and the characters were so different that the only thing resembling the original was, again, the roles, the position of the people in respect to each other's lives. They didn't so much resemble them in personality or character. We had that freedom to create new people. Obviously, again, an obvious difference is that we're talking about the 1930s and then the 1980s.
Right.
You know, so again, modern versus, you know, versus old American, you know, mid 20th century America.
Right.
America, you know, and also Italian immigrants versus modern Cuban, you know, immigrant thugs, you know, basically.
Right.
And so there was so, when I looked at the original, and I did, believe me, I thought about it, and, you know, and there were people, of course, with no modern Scarface, before we created it, the only thing people thought about was, hey, you're going to redo the original Scarface, and, you know, not a lot of people knew the original Scarface, because, as you know, as a student of it, I know you know that it hadn't been seen a lot, especially because it had been basically censored and not seen the light of day a lot with American pop culture.
That's very true.
Right. It was something that was like you heard about it. You heard about the original Scarface a lot. You could research it. You could find it. but you couldn't really see it. It wasn't real accessible. So for us, it was like, ooh, wow, the icon, you know, Scarface, you know, and Paul Muni, absolutely. Paul Muni much more so because he was such a brilliant, such a giant of an actor.
Right.
Muni. But George Raft was more of a movie star. And Raft's character, when I looked at it before I did the movie, I did take a look at the original, and I saw that it was, you know, his role was not even, you know, it wasn't even like a tenth of what I saw on the page.
Right.
What I was getting the opportunity to take on. I was like, oh, man, thank God. You know, I was like, wow. You know, poor George had like almost like a cardboard character.
I agree.
To play with. What he created was great because he had a lot of style, and he had that little thing, you know, that thing he did with the flipping the coin.
Yeah,
he had a thing that he did, and it's funny because I there were like a couple of old timers I think at the time when I was like starting the movie, and Al would introduce me to like friends of his, old actors or something. They say, and this is the guy he's playing, and they go, and these actors would be like, oh, you're playing the George Raft role. Do the thing. Are you gonna flip the thing with the? Are you going to flip the coin? And I'm like, no. I was like, I don't think so. I don't think this is, no, I don't think so.
No, that's...
Then what are you going to do? And I go, I'm going to stick my tongue out at some real. No.
Mr. Bauer, why do you think the movie's endured like it has?
Oh man, you know why? Because it was so wild what we were doing. You know what's great is that all the elements were in place. It's one of those like magical things. Here's the deal: you get this great story, right? That's mm-hmm. there. That's a classic. The story itself, but Oliver's script, because Oliver, being the wild man that he is, had been here, had been in Miami in those years in the early '80s, and had seen and hung out with the bad guys as well as the good guys.
Right.
You know, he did. He mixed with the criminals and the crime and the police, you know, and the law enforcement guys. He hung out with them because he's like that. You know, he's like, he wants to get in, you know, and like soak it all up. And that he did. So he got a lot of the language. He got some of the stuff that's where he got the chainsaw idea, because he had heard the story. He had heard that, because there's some crazy things that were done, you know, a lot of violent, you know, crazy violence in those years, and he put it into the script. So then you have this great cast that comes together, this ensemble chosen, you know, by a very, very astute and very, very a man with great taste, of the producer Marty Bregman,
mm-hmm.
and Brian De Palma, who just had the perfect feel, the perfect sense of style, you know, stylistically, he had the visually, you know, the cinematographer who passed away,
John
Alonso, and then again, personality wise, you have Brian De Palma knew enough somehow he knew enough, and he had enough respect for Al and for the rest of it, and it just passed on to all the actors, the way he dealt with all the actors, mm-hmm. that he gave us a lot of room, a lot of freedom to be flamboyant, to be out there on the edge with these characters, to not be careful. So none of the performances are careful or predictable. They're weird. They're kinky. You know, they're kind of quirky.
Yeah.
So you know, all the performances. I mean, like bang, 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 bang. You know, you go, you meet all these characters, and all the main characters are all kind of quirky and different. You haven't, they're not archetypes of characters you've seen in American film up to that point.
Yeah.
They're brand new. And that's what we were doing every day, every single day. When we got together, we were like, we got to push this, you know. We knew it was different. First of all, we're saying four-letter words, you know, in every sentence almost, you know. And on every page of the script, we're cursing like no one's ever cursed in American movies. So we know that on the set, like, and they're saying, like, can you believe we're like, well, this is the way we're going to talk through the whole film? This is the dialogue? this we're going to talk, and then we'd talk like that, and we would talk like that off the set, too, you know. We'd be like, are you kidding me, man? This is what we're doing, you know. And we would be talking like I was there. This is the way we're going to talk. What are the people going to think? What's the audience going to think? How's the audience going to react to this? How are the critics going to react? You know, and I used to, every once in a while, I would venture this question, this, like, philosophical, hypothetical question to Al, you know. and just, you know, at the risk of him, like, at the risk of him telling me to, like, bug off or stop thinking about the future, you know, stop thinking about the results. But, you know, but every once in a while, we'd finish a scene, we'd come back to his trailer, and we'd just, like, whew, it was like, wow, what do we just do? Because we do a lot of takes, so we knew that there was, like, a lot of material there for Brian and the editors to get into after, you know, for them to choose from. There was going to be a lot of material and a lot of options because we did a lot of takes. I've been hearing recently, I mean, since then, I didn't run into it, you know, that kind of like many takes, you know,
right.
For a long time until recently I started hearing about Michael Mann, and I was talking to Jamie Foxx, and I met him down here in Miami and at the beach, and he's talking about how many takes they do, how many takes Michael does, you know, which is incredible. It's crazy. I mean, and it makes us look silly. It makes us look amateur with Scarface. I mean, they do a lot of takes. They do 40 and, you know, 50 takes of like one, you know, one scene, one moment or something. And I thought we did a lot. We would do like 17, 25 takes of one like moment.
Right.
And Brian would give it to him. Yes. You know, I'd say us, but it was, you know, it was Al and me and Omar, I mean, and Murray and Bob Loggia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we'd go, like, we'd do like the first few. And, you know, and you'd think, well, that was it. We got it. We got the scene, you know. And then Al would, like, pull me aside, and he'd go, like, what do you think? I say, it's all right. I think we got it. And he'd say, I think we need one more. Sweet. So we'd go, okay, let's do one more. Okay, so he'd go, Brian, can we do one more? So we'd do one more, and then it would be like, we'd do, like, 15 more, you know.
I hear that he's never happier than when he's just working it out, you know.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, I got to know about his creative process and what you observed from his creative process and learned from him.
Well, what I can tell you is this, is that he really, you know, and I was really happy about this because I, you know, I'd heard people would tell me all kinds of things to prepare me. And I'm very instinctive, but I'm also a very good student because I had a great teacher with Stella, she really taught me, and my, another teacher I had, Harry Master George, taught me to really respect the writer and know what the writer intended, and when it's good writing, you know, when it's, you know, when you're just, you know, improvising, you improvise, and
right,
you know, but the thing about Al is that he really was, we had a very instinctive and a very, very organic way of going about finding these, creating these guys that we were given the opportunity to spend a lot of time together. And so we talked about everything. We could talk about anything as the characters. We talked about our lives. We gave ourselves a history so that once we walked on the set, we knew who we were, and things could happen. There could be accidents. There could be improvisation within the boundaries of what the intention of the scene was. And Brian De Palma knew enough to let those things happen, to give us a lot of room. And Al always had that. He always had that. He's always got that room for something to happen in the scene in that moment. So it's not set in stone, you know, and so it never feels stiff. It never feels stale. You know, you don't like rehearse things to death with him. We just do it, you know, we just do it. And then, you know, we'll do it a different way, you know, and do it again. Like, it's a really, really great process.
Yeah. Well, what's ahead for you?
Well, I just finished a really cool movie that I'm starring in. I've got the main role with a young actress who's a Israeli supermodel.
Mm.
Her name is Bar Rafaeli. She's actually also Leonardo DiCaprio's girlfriend. And,
oh wow!
okay.
Sweetheart. And the movie's directed by Haim Buzagla, who's a really strong, really creative Israeli director.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll probably be you'll probably see it on festival circuit. Probably ready in November, December this year.
Okay.
Got another movie coming out this year called From Mexico with Love, with a young actor, Kuno Becker, and that should be out maybe at the end of the summer, hopefully.
We'll definitely look forward to those films. And
yes.
Mr. Bauer, thank you so much for calling in and joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
That's proud. Thanks so much.
It's a tremendous honor. Thank you.
God bless everybody. Okay.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
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 All righty. Stephen Bauer. Chris, I believe our next guest is all set and ready to go. You want to give us the intro?
Yeah. We turn now to Al Pacino, the film director. The first two directorial efforts by Mr. Pacino, Looking for Richard and Chinese Coffee, are now available on a special four-disc DVD box set entitled An Actor's Vision. These passion projects, on which Pacino endlessly molded for a number of years on breaks from his film work, provide an unparalleled insight into the artist and the man, illuminating his creative process in a manner Pacino fans have never witnessed. During this broadcast, we've delivered the scoop on Pacino's latest passion project, Salome. It's based upon Pacino's experience with the Oscar Wilde play, Salome, a production in which he has invested a great number of years in a number of incarnations and venues. We'll be speaking to five actors in the upcoming film. Four will join us at the top of the broadcast second hour. Right now, we're privileged to have on the show Corey Lee Loisel, who plays Salome in the film. Ms. Loisel has stunned audiences with her terrific performances in a number of shows, both in Massachusetts and New York. She's been featured on television and in independent films, and she's the vice president of the Cassiopeia Theater Company in Los Angeles. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Ms. Corey Lee Loisel.
Corey, are you there? Is this Corey? I don't believe Corey called in. I thought that was the number for Corey right there, but all right. Well, that was a nice intro, Chris.
That was a great intro.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. We've never done this before. We actually have, I guess Ms. Loisel isn't calling in at the moment, but we do have, as Chris mentioned, four actors from Salome at the top of the hour in just a minute or two. And we've never had four guests on the show at one time. Four live lines. You can only have up to five live lines on the Blog Talk Radio server. So as soon as I see that everyone is all set and ready to go on the phone here, I'm going to mute Jerry and Chris. Sorry, guys.
That's okay.
And conduct the interview with our guests. So I have a number here that I don't recognize, but we'll be figuring that out. So, yeah, Mr. Bauer, tremendous talent and great insight into one of our great films of the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
He's a pretty awesome storyteller, too.
Yes, he is.
Sounds like he's just got a lot of story. It's a shame we were only able to touch on Scarface, really, because looking down his list of credentials, it seems like he could talk about a lot of other great movies.
Raising Kane and Traffic.
Yeah.
Raising Kane, Traffic, Running Scared.
Yeah, Running Scared.
Yeah, I'll mention there in his intro, just a bunch of great, terrific work. And, you know, I'd love to know what the Steven Soderbergh experience is like and what was different about his De Palma experience on Raising Kane, which was many years after his efforts in Scarface.
Yeah, 10 years later, so.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's just an amazing actor. And
I'm still in a state of shock, okay? We just interviewed Manny, okay? I'm in a state of shock, okay? I can't contain myself. And we're talking about De Palma, okay? I'm just, like, really still in a state.
I know it's special for you, Jerry.
You're pretty, you know it.
We all love De Palma, but I think you've got a special love for him.
Yes, I
do. Like, we'll get into that.
Yeah, we're not going to get into that right now.
That's hours of therapy right there.
Yes, it is.
And I'm not trained in that field.
None of us are.
But definitely, we're actually thinking of doing a De Palma tribute in the next month or so. So you'll be able to feed your obsession with De Palma at that time.
I will, definitely.
Yeah, that'll be great. All right, gentlemen, our four guests are on the line, so I'll see you on the other side of this interview.
Okay.
All right, well, Chris just gave you the lowdown on the new film Salamaybe from Al Pacino. Now we're going to hear from four actors from that film. You can find links to all of these fine actors on our MySpace blog at myspace.com/MovieGeeksUnited and on the show notes section of the Blog Talk Radio page you're listening to the show from right now. They are truly a terrific group of creative talents, and it is my pleasure to welcome all of them on the show. Starting with Joe Rizzetto. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Hey, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Waiting to get on, I was more nervous than being on stage with Pacino. Gosh, I heard the Corey introduction, and I was talking, and nobody heard me.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry about that. Let me bring on your co-stars real quick. We also have Mr. Pancho Hodges from the Salamaybe film. Pancho, are you there?
I am right here. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Mr. Jeffrey Owens. Jeffrey?
Yeah. Yeah, hi.
Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we also have Mr. Steve Roman.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Steve. Thank you so much for calling in.
My pleasure.
Okay, this might be a little tricky because we have four live lines here, but I'm so honored to have you all with us, and I couldn't pass up a chance to speak to each and every one of you. I've got questions for all of you. But if we could go one by one here, starting with Jeffrey, when did you first meet Mr. Pacino, and what role did you play in Salamaybe?
I met Pacino when we started rehearsals for the first phase of the reading in Los Angeles of Salome at the Tiffany Theater, the Actors Studio space in Los Angeles, in January of 2006. And I played Tigellinus, the Roman ambassador to the court of King Herod in the play. Tigellinus.
So I know three of you were actually in the production. Is that correct? That's correct. Production.
Steve and Joe and I, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how
just
did
three
how,
of us, no one else, yeah.
So how did you, what was your impression of Mr. Pacino when you first met him, Jeffrey?
That he was extremely generous and very gracious. I mean, we were all, like, very aware of the fact that he's Al Pacino. He is aware of it, too, and he made it very easy for us. I mean, I'm speaking for myself, but I felt like he went out of his way to put us all at ease and just, be an actor in an ensemble, and he was just very gracious and very kind throughout the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Joe, how about you?
Well, I recall the first day he walked in, we had all been together and rehearsing for about a week, and Estelle Parsons was directing the stage production, and the door kind of creaked open, and Estelle stopped and said, "I think we have a visitor," and you heard the familiar voice, you didn't see him yet, and he kind of saunters in and says, "Hey, guys, how's it going?" And behind him is his little, I guess, 4 or 5-year-old son, Anton, at the time. And he says, "How long have you guys been rehearsing?" And we said, "For a couple days and for a couple hours." And he said, "Oh, what dedication." And he went on to say, "You know, I've been rehearsing this play for years. I did readings and readings of it. I just love this play, guys." And he was impassioned, and he was looking us all in the eye, and we all were, at least I know I was, mesmerized. I was like, "Wow, this is Al Pacino talking to us." And he says, "There's everything in life is in this play. There's love, there's passion, humor, ecstasy, betrayal, jealousy, everything in life. I so love this play. Everything is in this play." And all of a sudden, without missing a beat, Anton takes down his water bottle that he was drinking or whatever and looks at everybody and just says, "Yeah." In full agreement. I don't know if you guys remember that.
I don't. That's amazing.
He was just like, "Yep, that's my dad." You know, it was classic.
Oh, wow. Pancho, how about you? How did you first come to meet Al Pacino?
Wow. You know, it was funny because when I was casted for the project, I immediately started working the following day. And we also, you know, I worked on the second phase, which was the desert sequence. I played the executioner of John the Baptist.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was one of those kind of things where we were sitting in the theater waiting for him to come, myself and other co-stars. And, you know, he was running late. One of the people in the production came and said, "Hey, he's running a little bit late, but he'll be here." So So I'm sitting there, and for me, you know, Al Pacino is my favorite actor. So I'm already being an actor myself, and just, you know, there's certain people as an actor, there's certain people that you have kind of like a wish list that you could work with.
Yeah.
And, of course, Al Pacino was somebody that I couldn't even fathom being able to work with. But here I am sitting in the theater waiting for him to come, and everybody's sitting there, and all of a sudden we're sitting there in the audience, and on the stage we just hear these footsteps, and I kind of look around the corner of the curtains, and I just see him walking, and I'm just like, whoa. I'm like sitting to myself, wow, that's Al Pacino. Okay, wow, okay. Let me get my poise together. So, you know, he comes up and he's like, hey, you know that voice, hey, can everybody, like, come down here so I can speak to you? So we go down there and he starts speaking to us. And I could just look around at the other actors and I could tell that I couldn't have been the only one that was feeling what I was feeling, just being mesmerized in, as far as being in his presence.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the great thing about him was that he just made everybody feel so comfortable. It wasn't like,
right,
he was throwing it at you like, I'm Al Pacino, you need to shut up and listen to me and blah, 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 whatever. We were already listening, and he was cracking jokes. He was, you know, asking everybody's name and just carrying on regular conversation, and that just made it so much more easier for us, because then we had a rehearsal, and we were doing the blocking of where we're going to be, you know, our placement for the following day. So after I met him, I was like, man, this guy is the greatest. And it just made me love him even much more as an actor and also as a person. So it was great for me.
Absolutely. Steve, did you have a similar experience?
Yeah, I did. I remember Joe's story. I remember that first day being in the theater. We'd actually been rehearsing for a couple of days, like Joe said, and him coming in, and it just being such a surreal moment. But, you know, immediately putting us at ease, and just a true professional that he is, you know, just rehearsing with him and the process with him was very much a collaborative effort, even though he's been working on this part for years.
Mm-hmm.
Just very generous as a person, as an actor. It was amazing. It was amazing meeting him that first day. It was amazing working with him, and it was great times.
Mm. Joe, how was Pacino as director?
He was fantastic. I mean, my role was the young Syrian, which basically, in the beginning of the play, is lusting after and in love with Salome. And it turns out that Salome seduces him into letting John the Baptist out of his prison, out of his well. And once he does that, she falls in lust and love with John the Baptist. And so distraught by this, my character professes his love even greater in a big emotional outburst, and then spontaneously killed himself.
Mm.
So, you know, so as an actor, you look at the script, I think the line is, ah, you know, A-H-H-H, exclamation point. And so we were lucky enough to have been doing the performance on stage before we did the film. So, you know, working with everybody, and like Steve said, it's a collaborative effort, and really, you know, working, getting connected to the material and ourselves as actors and the story we're telling and all that. So when we got to the set, we were pretty well rehearsed, which was nice, which is rare. And it was interesting because, you know, here we are still on set, and Pacino takes the helm now as the director, and here's this big moment. I have to kill myself, stab myself, scream, whatever, do this thing, and it's going to be on film now. So and I think you guys were making, you know, would time me every night to how long my scream would be. You know, I was a little longer. Was your mom in the audience? You know, but anyway. So we get to the film set, and Al was very, very caring about it. He came up to me and said, "We're going to do this a couple times. I'm going to empty out two big magazines of film. We're going to have two dollies. We're going to come in, and then we're going to come out. And we're going to do it again." So, you know, I was struggling with it. I was kind of muscling it and forcing it and trying to, you know, really work it. And I kind of was having trouble getting to the real place of despair that I needed to be in. And he was right there with me. I mean, he, you know, it got to a point where he said, back the cameras up, do it again. Back them up, do it again. And it got to a point where he was so impassioned. And again, it was just his voice because he was yards away. It was a big soundstage. And, it got to a point where it was like the cameras on the dollies were like breaths. I felt like I was in Pacino's lungs, coming in and out and in and out. And finally he said, say whatever you want to say. Forget the camera. Forget the words. Say what you want to say. And that really freed me. And it was just a big moment for me as an actor with a director with this, you know, an idol of mine.
Yeah.
And where I really you know, said what I wanted to say. I don't know what that is. I haven't seen the film yet. We'll see what I said. But, you know, something really nice happened between an actor and director, and to have it happen with him was even more special. And then, you know, what was interesting, the death scene, the big scream that was done on stage that had to reach, you know, 2,000 people, he came up to me after that and said, we're going to do it different than we're doing it on stage. We're going to do it silent. He said, we're just going to have the life sucked out of you. Like, you're just going to... So after this catharsis, I just had... And he did it for me. He said, do it like this. And he did it, of course, brilliantly. And I thought, okay, I'll try, you know. But after this big cathartic moment, you know, of course, that silence and that death and that fall to my knees after stabbing myself was, you know, hopefully... What he was looking for, it certainly was a moment for me that I'll never forget.
We've heard over and over again about his generosity as a creative partner and as an actor. Pancho, what did you learn from watching Pacino at work?
Oh man, just kind of how to relax. You know, you would expect from someone, you know, his caliber for, you know, since he was the director, that's the whole other thing that I had to get over. It wasn't the fact that just that if I was just in the film being a co-star with him, but I had to be directed by him. So that's a whole another thing that you have to get over. So he's standing there talking to me, telling me what he wants me to project on camera, and I'm sitting there listening to him, and he's just like, you know, he's cracking jokes with me, and he's just like asking me how my day is going and things like that. So I'm relaxed. You know, he's helping me out. And just, you know, just watching him direct other people, he was just so relaxed, and it's just a great thing to, you know, because when you go to a set like that and you're going to be directed by someone, you know, like him, you're expecting that it's going to be like a tight set, like everybody's going to be uptight. But I just learned how to just relax and just approach it the same way that I would approach any other project, any other film, no matter, you know, if I can do that without Pacino, any other project that I come across, man, it's never going to be a problem for me to relax. So that's the main thing that I learned from him, just to sit back and relax, take everything in, and just approach the craft just like any other, you know, any other project.
Jeffrey, what about you? What did you take from your experience with him?
Just, again, how he really wanted us to do our best. I remember him saying from time to time, I'm not going to let you look bad. I'm not going to let you look bad. That was so reassuring because he knows what it takes to look good on film. And he was going to make sure we did it as many times as we needed to, or to work the process we needed to, so that we got it to the point where we were going to look good. That's very reassuring. That was very reassuring for me. At one point, I was doing something that I'd done on stage for a while, and he just said, okay, just do it, you know, it's one of those classic things, do it smaller now, just to me.
Uh-huh.
And I did it very differently than I did it on stage. And he said, he just kind of looked at me and said, excellent. And I tell you, that excellent meant the world to me coming from him. He's just very, very generous, as I said before.
Yeah. Steve, what did you take from watching his creative process and working with him both as a director and an actor?
You know, one of the main things I recall when we were shooting the film one day, and it was a little bit hectic. I think we were missing a prop or something, and you know, Al was like so in control of everything. And at one moment, he said, "40 years I've been making films, boys, 40 years," and we all just kind of had a chuckle and whatnot. But I mean, the guy is so amazing in the sense that he's directing this film, he's starring in it, and at the same time, while he's acting and the cameras are rolling, he's able to say it again, take it again, you know, and then get right back in character and be there. I guess that confidence that he exudes was something that I took from this. Also, what everyone else has been saying about how, you know, it was a collaborative effort, what we've all said, and that he made us all feel very much at ease with our work. It was never about just him looking good. It was always about the project being good. So all of that, you know, and just his confidence in making films.
Yeah, and it seems like, too, Steve, that if you can speak to this, it seems like he is just as passionate as he was just starting out.
You know, I mean, this is a character that he's been working on for, I think he did it in the mid-80s originally, played King Herod at Circle in the Square production. And so he's been working on it for a number of years. And, you know, to have that passion and to get up on stage every night and find something new in Herod, And then to, you know, want to do this passion project, this film, this documentary of the process and everything. I mean, yes, this is a guy that, you know, still is very passionate about it, and you know, he's someone to look up to.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I really appreciate having you all on tonight. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but when the film comes out, you guys have to come back on our show and talk more about this project.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you all for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That is Steve Roman, Joe Rossetto, Pancho Hodges, and Jeffrey Owens. Okay, now we're going to bring back up Chris and Jerry. Chris, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, and Jerry?
Yeah, I'm here. You did a great job.
Thank you.
That was fascinating.
All right. The next guest that we're expecting to call in any moment now is director Jerry Schatzberg. And we're all very excited to speak with him. And actually, I see that he's on the line right now, so let's get started. We've just heard from actors who have been directed by Pacino, and now it's time to explore what it's like for someone to direct him. In the field of photography and feature filmmaking, our next guest tonight is nothing short of legendary. Before making his mark in films in the early 70s, Jerry Schatzberg had already crafted a career as one of our top professional photographers, having captured a series of intimate and revealing portraits that were featured by the likes of Vogue, Esquire, McCall's, and Life magazines. Perhaps his most iconic images are those featuring a young Bob Dylan, particularly a candid image that went on to grace the cover of Dylan's classic album, Blonde on Blonde. He used his extensive experience in photography to inform his first feature film in 1970, Puzzle of a Downfall Child, starring Faye Dunaway. In 1971's The Panic in Needle Park, which has just been made available on DVD, Mr. Schatzberg directed Al Pacino in his first starring role as one half of a young couple trying to survive in the throes of heroin addiction. The film went on to receive a Golden Palm nomination at the Cannes Film Festival, an award that he would win for his next Pacino collaboration, Scarecrow, in 1973, co-starring Gene Hackman. Over the years, he's gone on to direct unforgettable classics like Honeysuckle Rose, Misunderstood, Reunion, and Street Smart. In film after film, his artistic vision has been distinguished by an unflinching eye, a compassionate heart, and an endless pursuit of truth. Welcome to the show, a truly exceptional artist, Mr. Jerry Schatzberg. Mr. Schatzberg,
hey.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hey, that's quite an introduction. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us. It's really an honor for me to be able to speak with you.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, and as you know, it's a pleasure for me to talk about Al, too, so there's no problem at all. You know, I was thinking while you were talking about all those people that I photographed, I realized that I had photographed Al only once, and that was one Polaroid in all that time, because I was never of the mind to really photograph the actors I worked with, because I had something else to do, and I was too, you know, concerned with that. But
yeah.
It's funny to hear about all those other photographs and then realize I only photographed Al once.
Yeah. When were you first made aware of Pacino? Did he audition for you for Panic, or...?
No, I had seen him several years before that on stage in Indian Wants the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
and I thought he was just unbelievable. I mean, it was so powerful, and it moved me so, and I was with Marty Bregman at the time. Marty later became his manager, and I said, my God, if ever I directed a film, because I hadn't done any films yet, if ever I directed a film, that's the actor I'd like to work with. Mm. We went backstage, and... met him after, and as I say, Marty eventually started to manage him, but I don't know if it's known or not known, but I've told the story a number of times, because I had first turned down Panic in Needle Park, because the lab had scratched the last 6 minutes of my first film, and I was very upset, and I wasn't really thinking too much of my next film. I was just working on this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to Marty's office, and he said, you know, there's a really good script out there. I said, what was it? He said, well, it's called Panic in Needle Park. I said, you know, I think I just turned that down. He said, but, you know, Al is interested. And that sort of changed the whole thing. I went back, reread it. went back to the producers, told them how foolish I was, and I think they agreed with me, but they were kind enough to give me another shot at it, and that's how it started with Alan.
Mm. What did you see in him that you thought that he could bring to this character in Panic?
Well, it was just such power. First of all, when I read it the second time, he was the character. I mean, I didn't think that he had to even act. Of course, that's not true, but I just saw the character. He uh-huh. became the character for me. And not being a student of acting, I depended on things like that at the beginning.
Yeah. Was there a rehearsal process involved in this film?
Yeah. Well, actually, it was more than a rehearsal process, because this was Al's first major film. And he, Kitty, and I, we just hung out for about a month and a half together. We'd go to places where junkies were. We'd go to hospitals. We'd go to seminars. We just really hung out. We got to know each other. We got to know them. We saw awful things that we related to for our characters. But it's sort of something that doesn't really happen in most films, because economically it's not feasible for actors to give up a month and a half of their time to just hang out.
Yeah, it's a real luxury, I would think. Yeah,
yeah, it is.
You know, and all that experience, it definitely made it onto the screen, all of that rehearsal time and all that experience you had pre-production.
Well, I'm pleased when Al always says he thinks it's his best role, and in some ways I understand what he's talking about, because he had the most freedom to express himself.
Yeah. Well, he was actually, he showed 8 minutes of Panic in Needle Park to the studio behind The Godfather. Is this true? And
actually, it was about 20 minutes, because he screen tested 4 times for Paramount. Francis Coppola had seen him on the stage the same way I had, and Francis wanted him. There was no question about it. But it's Paramount that didn't want him, and he screen tested 4 times. I had put together a 20-minute version of Panic so that we could take it around to distributors and such, and Al asked if I would send it to Francis, and I did, and obviously he showed it to Paramount, and they changed their mind.
Mm. I have to ask you about Scarecrow, because this is absolutely one of my favorite movies.
Oh, thank you.
And I know that it's a script that Pacino particularly loved and championed. At least that's what I heard. Is that true?
When we were shooting, or just after we were shooting Panic, he was telling me about Scarecrow. Mm. I was not involved in it, and I don't know, something happened. Something must have happened with the director that was involved with it, and both he and Hackman didn't want to do the film with that director, so I guess they had a conversation. My agent, who was also Al's agent, sent it to me, and I didn't quite know what for, and I called him, and he told me, read it and tell me if you like it. Mm. I did, and they said, well, and they told us the situation. After a while, both Al and I, you know, we felt a little bit guilty about the situation, and we told our agent, we don't really like acing somebody out of a script like that. It just doesn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
And he got furious and said to me, anyhow, do you like the script? I said, yes, I do. He says, well, just leave the rest to me. And they made some arrangement in which everything was very amicable.
Mm. Well, in the film, Gene Hackman, Gene Hackman has said that this is his personal favorite out of all of his own performances.
I've read
that many times.
That.
But Gene Hackman and Al Pacino, they essentially play two hobos that form a bond.
Mm-hmm.
Hackman is the kind of the tough and embittered half, and Pacino is the soft-hearted and vulnerable one.
Right.
Were their working styles very different?
Yes. I always said that, you know, Gene would come in and he'd put on his costume and he became the character. Al sort of carried it with him most of the time. And I think in some ways, although I know Gene respected his acting, he was a little bit maybe, I wouldn't say nervous, but he understood that Al and I had worked together, so he was a little bit cautious about that. But Al always, you know, just took more time, and Gene was always, I mean, Gene's the ultimate professional. He's always right there, always on time, you know, and Al isn't, but every actor is different, and every actor needs different care, and I think in some ways affected their relationship. And I saw that at one point Gene was trying to intimidate Al, and I thought it over, and I thought, well, you know, that's really what's happening in the film.
Exactly, yeah.
So I'll just leave it happen for a while. But years later, I started to realize that that was Gene preparing himself for that character. I don't think it was something personal. I think it was Gene just preparing himself for that character. Al was the other character. Because Al becomes the characters that he takes on. You know,
yeah.
There's an actress in Scarecrow, Penny Allen.
Yes, yes.
And she plays Al's wife. And from the first time she read for me till the time we performed it on film, she would be just as dynamic in that role. And I said to Al, I said, tell me, what is it that allows her to be so right on every single time? And he said, you know, if you tell her she's a chair, she's a chair. And I realized that's the way Al is. If you tell him he is something or you show him a character, he becomes that character.
Wow. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that scene specifically, because Penny Allen, as you say, that's the only scene she has in the film, correct?
Right.
And it is a high point of the film. It's a phone conversation between Pacino and Penny Allen.
Right.
And phone acting, how does that work? Do each of them have someone to play off of? Or?
I believe she was on the other end of that phone.
Yeah.
And he was on the other end of that phone, because I usually try to make it as honest as possible.
Yeah.
And but as I say with her, I've seen her do that maybe 8, 9, 10 times, because every time she would do it, she'd be that powerful. And Al was the same way. And they were just into that scene.
It's very interesting, because these are among two of my favorite moments from Pacino's films. The phone conversation in Scarecrow and the phone conversation in Dog Day Afternoon. He just excels in both of those moments.
But you know, to be a director with actors like that is something extraordinary. I would stand behind the camera sometime, and I know that we talk a lot about different aspects of the character, about different aspects of the film, but when you stand behind the camera and you see them do things that are just so amazing, you just say to yourself, how did they get to that? Because, you know, we never got near that in our discussions, but that's their craft, that's their talent.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the rehearsal period for Scarecrow, I understand that they actually, Hackman and Pacino actually went hitching together for a period of time?
Yeah, they went up to San Francisco for a while, and they went around together, but I wasn't involved in that. I sanctioned it, and I just said I thought it was a great idea, and they did that. I think they're a great combination, and the first scene in the diner, which goes on for 8 minutes, I just barely put one cut in there, because they were so fantastic going
on. That's right, yeah.
You know, in a scene together, and they're just, you know, I've seen great actors. I've seen Olivier do The Telephone Book, and he was great. You know, that's the way these actors are.
You shot it in continuity as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
How important was that, given the nature of the relationship that they had to build in the film? What does that do for
actors? Well, I think it's important to the actors. It's important to the director, because we can think, you know, linearly. We can think what's happening next. If, doing a film is like being in a time capsule, because you go to the end, you know, you stop at the end, you go back to the middle, you come back to the end, you're back to the beginning. And it's very difficult to keep your emotions, your moods. But for an actor, and I think Gene has mentioned this a number of times, it was just such a pleasure for them. Well, for them, it's like doing a play.
And right.
I've always heard actors say that they get more out of doing theater because film sort of takes things out of you while theater puts things into you.
Yeah.
And I think it has a lot to do with the continuity of acting.
I couldn't let you go without asking about some of the other outstanding talents that you've worked with, just to get your impressions on them. I know you worked with Meryl Streep.
Yes.
What was your impression of her?
Well, see, I didn't know Meryl before she came in. She actually came in and read for me, which I feel now privileged. But she came in, and I just was astounded by her reading. Same thing happened with Morgan Freeman. He came in and he read for me, and because I, you know, Morgan had been around for 30 years, but he didn't do any films. Meryl hadn't had any films out. Actually, while we were shooting, the television series came out, and she was an instant star. You know, before that, we'd go to dinner and everything. Nobody would even take notice, and as soon as the television series came out, that was before Deer Hunter.
Yes. She was in Holocaust.
Holocaust, yeah,
yeah.
Holocaust came out, and she was an immediate success.
Mm.
And she's one of the nicest people in the world.
Yeah. Also Morgan Freeman, who just dynamic and street smart, just incredible performance. What was that experience like? What is Morgan?
Well, he came in. Well, the whole experience was great, but he came in, and he's very cool. It was not in my mind to have somebody that old in the part, but he just sat down, talked for a little bit, reached in his bag, took out a banana, started eating it. It was just something, and a lot of my casting has to do with my conversations with them and my impressions. I went home that night, and I said to my wife, I read an actor today that was just fantastic. I think I'm going to change the part so he can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I spoke to him about it, I said, if you were CEO of General Motors, that's the way you would handle the street. And he went ahead. You know, he just started building on that.
Oh, goodness. Well, you've done extraordinary work, Mr. Schatzberg, and I can't thank you enough for doing our show. I understand that you have a birthday coming up.
Oh.
We have to wish you a happy birthday.
Yes. Thank you. That's in 2 days.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Yes, well, thank you.
My pleasure. It really is.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Jerry Schatzberg, he is a tremendous talent, and we're so honored to have had him call into the show and participate. We're going to wait a little while until our last guest, comes on the phone. It's been an exciting show so far, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Chris?
I think it's been really informative, and man, does Pacino sound like the biggest sweetheart in the world, or what?
I know.
Everybody we've talked to seems like they, you know, even if they've worked with him, you know, years and years ago, they still got like this, you know, this crush on him.
I know.
He's
yeah.
Just a nice guy, it seems.
I think that's part of why he is so good as an actor too. Like we talked about earlier. He has that kind open heart and a sensitivity. And I think that's the one main quality you need to have to be a great actor. That's what I've always thought.
There's so many actors that you know, we don't have to mention names, you know, there's so many actors that have bad reputations. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, you know, anything negative about Pacino. Certainly not tonight.
Yeah, definitely not tonight.
Right.
But... you know, you got to be right. I mean, that's got to be why he's been so successful with his collaborations with these people, because he's just such a wonderful guy, so generous, as everyone said so many times.
We have a call from an Atlanta, Georgia number, and I don't believe this is our next guest because the number doesn't match what I have, but hopefully maybe it's a listener calling in. Let me see real quick. 404, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi.
404. Okay. I'm sorry, your phone is breaking up. Okay, 404 didn't work out, but
We're expecting Mr. William Scholl to call in any moment now. We're going to discuss his book, which I believe is the quintessential assessment of Pacino's film career. It's called The Films of Al Pacino. Just to touch base with you guys before we bring on Mr. Scholl, as we're waiting for his phone call, what film do you think will define Pacino the most?
Oh, that's a tough one.
Well, the one, you know, the performance that defines Pacino, you know, obviously I think The Godfather is maybe the best known movie of his.
Yes.
And it's definitely a great performance in all three movies.
Yes,
no doubt.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
But I think Scarface, for me, really defines what he's capable of. He'd already been working. He'd already achieved fame at that point. You know, he didn't need a knockout performance like that, and still he came through with it. And like we were talking about with Stephen Bauer earlier, the movie just continues to be known and talked about, and in any small part due to Pacino's performance. He's incredible in it.
Yeah.
He says that's what he'll be remembered for. He says there's no doubt that's the role that he will be remembered for.
Yeah. And it is, too, I've heard him say, it is his favorite performance out of his own. Several years ago I heard him say that, that Scarface was it for him, Tony Montana. Our next guest has arrived. We end tonight's broadcast with an overall assessment of Pacino's amazing film career, with a primary focus on the films and performances that don't get mentioned often enough. We are honored to have with us this evening the prolific author of The Films of Al Pacino, Mr. William Scholl. Mr. Scholl is the author of many film-related books, including Comic Book Heroes of the Screen, Stay Out of the Shower, and his latest book, The Sundance Kid, an unauthorized biography of Robert Redford. Two of his books have been national bestsellers, The Nightmare Never Ends, which chronicles the Nightmare on Elm Street phenomenon, and another in which he traced a phenomenon of a different kind, the Rat Pack. He is the executive editor of two online magazines, High and Low New York and Quirks Reviews Online. It is a privilege to welcome to the show Mr. William Scholl. Mr. Scholl, are you there? Hang on, I'm trying to mute him real quick. Mr. Scholl?
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for being on the show tonight.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I really enjoyed your book. It's an amazing, thorough, and insightful overview of each of the films that populate Pacino's resume.
Thank you.
While you're researching your book, what do you think makes Pacino unique as an actor, and why has he endured?
Because he's not afraid to be emotional and show passion on the screen. I think that a lot of male actors are terrified of being too emotional because they think it's unmanly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, men are trained to hide their emotions. Women are not conditioned to do that. They can be more emotional. But men are told you hide your emotions, and that can be deadly for an actor because we do have emotions, and we do show them when it's appropriate. And Pacino was never afraid to be an emotional actor. He's an emotional person in real life. He said he gets that from his mother. And that's one of his great strengths, is that he always gives a very passionate performance.
Yeah. Jerry and I were speaking earlier today, and he just rewatched Panic in Needle Park last night. And Jerry, you said that he was dynamic and just full of energy in that,
yes,
in the film. Yeah. And I think that kind of defines every performance he gives. There's always a passion there, that, and even 40 years in the business, it doesn't seem to have gone away. Or even waned in the least bit. So
not at all.
What do you think are the performances that will define him the most?
Well, I think you were mentioning Scarface. That seems to be with Pacino fans that I talk to. That seems to be the one that sticks in everybody's mind because he was so explosive in that. It was just a riveting performance. You can't take your eyes off him, and he seemed to be having a great fun playing Montana, and it was just extremely effective. And that seems to be the big one that everybody refers to, along, of course, with the Godfather films.
Yeah. Certainly those performances are legendary, and they've been discussed quite often and examined really brilliantly in your book. But I want to talk about some of these performances that aren't mentioned nearly enough in Pacino's resume.
Well, there are a few of them. I always felt that because the film didn't do well, Revolution, it wasn't a successful movie, and it was excoriated, and he was excoriated. But if you look at the film carefully, he really gives a wonderfully intense and real performance. There's one scene when his son is injured, and it's like he's living it. That's the best acting. When you don't feel you're seeing somebody acting. It's like you're looking through a time warp or something and just seeing it as it's actually happening.
Yeah.
And I think his performance in that was overlooked because nobody liked the movie, unfortunately. And
yeah,
Frankie and Johnny, he gave a performance very different from the Scarface. It wasn't quite as, explosive and dynamic, but he played a very real character, a very different kind of character, comparatively schlumpy, not as big a winner, but he gave a very charming performance in that.
I like that one, too.
You'd also mentioned, we've been corresponding by email for the past week or two, you also mentioned People I Know, which I think is a dynamic performance. It's from a film a few years back. Would that be one of his overlooked performances as well, do you think?
I think so. I think that film sort of came and went without making a big ripple. It's too bad. I thought it was a good picture, and he was mesmerizing. That's a perfect example of an actor can just take control of the screen, and he's just in top form through every single sequence. And whether you like the script or the movie or you didn't like it, you just can't take your eyes off him. He's just absolutely mesmeric in that. A terrific actor.
It's a very colorful character. I think his name is Eli Werman. He's an expert New York PR guy. And it's a very colorful character, but it never falls over into caricature.
Never, no. And it's a very different role from Tony Montana and those type of parts. And yet he still is riveting, you know, even though he's playing somebody not quite as over the top, you know, larger than life.
Yeah. Jerry, what do you think are some of Al Pacino's overlooked performances?
Well, I'm going to go with two that are kind of well known, but not really that. I don't think they're that respected. And the first one I'm going to go with is performance in The Third Godfather, which I think is just always overlooked. A lot of people cite Part 2, but I like Part 3 because he's trying to really go straight. He wants redemption. He wants to legitimize the family. And there are a couple scenes in the second half of the film where this is, he just does this beautifully. The scene in front of the Don Tomasino's casket.
Right.
And then when Vincent comes in, he hands over power to him.
Right.
And then there's this one little scene, it's only maybe a couple of seconds after the opera, where he's telling someone walking out, because they're all, you know, Anthony has made this just wonderful stage debut, and he goes, "Do you hear that? When people think of the name Corleone, they will not think, you know, of bad things, but they'll think of something good." And of course, it's short-lived, but it's just I always felt like he's trying to go straight, and you know people. And he even admits this in interviews. He goes, "People just didn't buy it. People weren't into it.
People didn't want to see the redemption of Michael Corleone.
No one did."
Yeah. You know, it's interesting too because the actor that we spoke to earlier, I believe it was Joe Rossetto, talking about how he was directed by Pacino to do his death scene as a silent scream, and that powerful moment, Godfather 3, it was edited without sound. Obviously.
Right.
He gave sound during the shooting of it. But that is one of his most powerful moments right there.
Right, absolutely.
A great summation of a character that lived with him for, you know, 30 years. Chris, what about you? What do you think is an overlooked performance?
For me, it's kind of an unusual choice, I guess. It's Big Boy Caprice in Dick Tracy. Because, you know, the movie is, for some reason,
brilliant.
I like the movie. And I've watched it recently. I still think it's good.
Oh, yeah.
But Pacino, that's really the biggest comedic performance he's ever given. I mean, that's all-out comedy. Like we were talking about, you were talking earlier about portraying a character without, you know, tipping over into caricature. Well, this is a caricature intentionally,
and he embraces it. Yeah.
Brilliant. This guy needs to make more comedies like that because he's truly a gifted comedian in this movie. There's a lot of colors in the movie, but there's no color, you know, more intense than his performance, which is hysterical.
Yeah,
it's another example of great acting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, drama, comedy, either end of the spectrum, he can do it. All great actors can really do that. He's brilliant in that. He's just hilarious.
And
yeah.
Mr. Scholl, I actually have three movies that I'm crazy about his performances in them. I don't think they get mentioned often enough, and maybe we can discuss these. Donnie Brasco.
Mm-hmm. He's excellent in that.
Yeah, it's like the Willie Loman of Michael Corleone, if Willie Loman met Michael Corleone, you know, it's just a sensational performance. And I'm taken by, and you referred to this in your book as the Pacino blast, I suppose it's the moment of theatricality in some of his works. Could you explain the Pacino blast?
Yeah, it's when he becomes absolutely furious at something that's been slowly building up through the movie.
Yeah.
And he just unleashes all his demons. He screams, he hollers, he rants, he bangs on doors, he overturns the furniture like in Serpico. He's like an animal that can be barely contained. And he only does it sparingly, which makes it more effective. And the first time he ever did it was in the Panic in Needle Park when he finds out that his girlfriend is turning tricks to get drugs.
Right.
And he just screams and loses all control. But, of course, he's such a good actor that it's always a controlled performance. It never goes into hamminess or chewing the scenery. It's just very, very strong.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that he's received some criticism as of late for that kind of approach, tinkering on too broad or overacting somehow. What's your take on that?
I can't think of a single instance where he ever overacted. I think a lot of people prefer the underplaying type of approach of a Robert Redford, a very, very different type of actor.
Mm-hmm.
And to people like that, they're always going to think Pacino is being too strong, too emotional. But that's his style, and it either works for you or it doesn't.
Yeah, and as I was saying earlier, how else would you want to see the devil played in The Devil's Advocate?
Another overlooked performance.
Absolutely. And he has so much, you can tell he has so much fun in that film. And who else would you want to handle a 20-minute monologue scene than Al Pacino? I know that Chris and I have discussed this many times. When you have a large chunk of dialogue, a large monologue, you just cannot beat Pacino.
Absolutely, and he's the devil's advocate. He's charming, witty, sinister, all at the same time. It's just a really marvelous performance, but for some reason the film hasn't stayed in the public's memory, and I thought it was a good movie, and I thought he was excellent.
Yeah. What did you think of his work in Insomnia?
Oh, Insomnia, he was terrific, a splendid performance. His character was made somewhat nicer than in the original film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the actor who was in the original film.
Stellan Skarsgård, is it? Was that it, Chris? Stellan Skarsgård?
Yeah,
He played a somewhat less likable, more sleazy type of character and was cleaned up a bit, but Pacino's terrific in that. A terrific performance, a very good movie.
Yeah, and just from a physical standpoint, that performance, just the subtle degradation of his character, because he lacks sleep and he's under all this pressure with the murder investigation and shooting his best friend and trying to find the killer, and it's just so expressive and so extraordinary. And to shoot out of sequence and to maintain that, it's just amazing.
That's one of the most difficult things actors have to contend with, is that they have to do a certain scene that's sort of like the reaction to something that happens earlier in the film, but they haven't done that scene yet. They're just doing the reaction. That can be difficult, but Pacino always manages.
Yeah. City Hall, while I didn't think it was, the movie quite made it, when people talk about his overreaching as of late, I think 98% of City Hall is an incredibly subtle performance. There is that one scene in the funeral home of the boy that got shot, when the mayor walks in and delivers a little eulogy there, that he kind of plays theatrically. But it's something that we were talking about earlier with the Pacino blast. He has said in interviews that when people edit his takes, when the editors use his takes, they always tend to use those scenes where he screams and is most robust, you know, because that's the Pacino that audiences want to see.
Exactly.
Whereas he says he tries it, you know, 10, 12 different ways. That's the take that they choose themselves.
And I think some viewers, some fans are disappointed with some movies because it doesn't give them the opportunity to do the Scarface type of emoting,
yeah,
like City Hall. He was excellent on The Picture, but it's almost like he was in a supporting role for John Cusack, and it didn't give him quite as many big moments, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for instance, in Justice for All gave him a lot of big moments.
That's true, yeah. And Justice for All is another great one, and just a famous scene there at the end of the courtroom, the "You're out of order" scene.
Yeah,
one of his biggest blasts.
Yeah,
yes,
that's absolutely correct. Is there a defining Pacino moment out of all of his work that you would point out, Mr. Scholl?
If getting back to Scarface at the ending when he goes to Defiance and takes his gun and is just shooting back, he's not going to give up. He's just going to keep struggling against all odds to survive. And if there's a theme in all the roles he plays, it's always somebody struggling just to survive, just to stay ahead of the game. It doesn't matter if he's a big winner, a rich guy, a Corleone, or a comparative loser like Carlito or Donnie Brasco, a schlump. It's always, that's one big theme that comes through, is he's just trying to stay ahead of the pack, just keep going, keep surviving.
Yeah, he has said that he's attracted to characters that exist on the edge.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and Sea of Love is another one where that's definitely a character that fits that mold. Now, that was the performance that he came back with after he took a hiatus from films after Revolution.
He was off the screen for four long years.
Yeah.
It was.
What were your impressions of his performance in Sea of Love?
Oh, it was an excellent performance again. I was never too crazy about the film itself, but I thought he was excellent in it.
Yeah.
I've never seen him really give a bad performance, even in things that are somewhat disappointing, like Author, and movies that he's miscast in. He's such a good actor that he triumphs over the miscasting, and he's never bad. You know, he may not be as riveting as he is in some films or as well cast, but he's never given a really bad performance that I can think of.
Yeah, and there's so many surprising moments in every performance he gives as well that I just relish. So you just did a book on Robert Redford.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the most surprising things that you learned in your research of Mr. Redford?
Well, Redford is not too many surprises. I mean, he's not someone who has a lot of deep dark secrets, but I found that he's started out as a serious theater actor, as Pacino did, but unlike Pacino, one of the best things about Pacino is that he keeps going back to the theater, accepting more and more challenges,
yeah.
Takes on roles that, whether they're appropriate or not, he never gives up. He always tries something different. Redford plays it much safer, has never gone back to the theater, never went back to the theater. Just, he's become a more typical movie star, and Pacino, while he's every inch the movie star, he's not so typical.
What is his impact on the industry?
Pacino, I think that he's just shown people that you can be a major movie star and still take on challenges,
mm-hmm.
and not forget your old friends. Another thing that's great about Pacino is that I spoke to many people who said he didn't forget the people who helped him on the way up.
Right.
He cast them in movies. He helped them out behind the scenes. He's just been a terrific guy to people who helped him. He doesn't forget his friends.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Scholl, we really appreciate having you on the show and giving us some insights into these different Pacino performances that are often overlooked, sadly. But thank you so much for calling in and being on the show.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
William Scholl, the book is The Films of Al Pacino. In a few minutes, we're going to play our Richard Cox interview from Friday. Richard Cox is a frequent collaborator with Pacino. They've done Looking for Richard and Sal and Maybe together, as well as several stage productions. And he was in Cruising with Pacino as well. So if you're an archive listener, you'll be able to hear that at the end of the show. And if you're listening live, then I would suggest just coming back to the show in the archive format and getting that little extra morsel at the end of this tribute. It's been a great group of guests, guys.
You did a great job. I mean, you did a really good job getting this all together.
Both of you guys did a great job.
No, it was all you. But
it was all you, Jamie. This was all, I mean, as I let people know, I mean, you really outdid yourself.
Thank you.
But I should tell everyone that they should definitely tune in and listen to Mr. Cox's interview, because he had a lot of interesting stuff to say about the craft and working with him. So
yeah, and he spilled some scoops on Heat. And
yes.
Yeah, which is a major film in his resume that we didn't even mention with Mr. Scholl. Well,
there's so many we didn't get to talk about.
Yeah.
You know? It's The Insider and The Scent of a Woman, which he won the Oscar for. There's
absolutely.
So much, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's been an amazing show, guys, and That's it. That's all the time we have.
All right. Well,
all right.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Thanks, everyone out there, for listening, and we'll see you next week. And we'll give a lowdown on what will be on next week's show midweek when we firm that up. So thanks so much for listening in, guys. Jerry, Chris, thanks for joining in the tribute.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll see you guys next week.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Cox is here. He's a highly talented and prolific actor whose resume spans more than 30 years. And during that time, he's crafted a series of outstanding film, television, and stage performances. His film credits include Pacino's Looking for Richard, Cruising, and the upcoming Salomaybe. His impressive television credits include roles on Crossing Jordan, The Closer, Cold Case, Numbers, Without a Trace, ER, Law and Order. Hang on, I got to catch my breath. And countless other landmark shows. He received a Drama Desk Award and Tony Award nominations for his stellar performance on Broadway in 1979's Platinum. He's had the pleasure to work with Pacino on several occasions, three times in the films that we just mentioned, and several other times in theater workshops. And now it is our pleasure to welcome to the show a terrific actor, Mr. Richard Cox.
Hi.
Hey. How are you?
Nice to hear your voice. I feel like I've known you for years.
I know. We've been corresponding through email for so long now. It's about time we get to speak. So thanks so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Tell me how, first of all, how you came to meet Pacino for the first time.
Well, the very first time I met him, I was doing a play. I was doing an off-Broadway play, I think, what the heck was it? I was going out with a girl who was playing Vanessa Redgrave's daughter in Lady of the Sea, the Ibsen play, rarely done Ibsen play. And at the time, there was this rumor floating around that there was a workshop that Pacino was doing of The Local Stigmatic. I think it was about the third time that he'd done it, and it was not publicized, but it was happening at 11 or 12 midnight at the Public Theater. This is a play you probably know about because it's coming out on the box set. It's
right, absolutely.
50 minutes long, and he was very, very interested in this play for years. He was doing it with John Cassell at the time at close to midnight down at the Public Theater, and I went with Vanessa Redgrave, of all people, as my date. We were all hanging out together because I was going out with this gal, Alison Argo, who played her daughter. And I said, hey, I've heard about this. And she said, I want to go to that. And I said, me too. I said, well, let's go together. And so I met Al Pacino for the very first time going backstage. We said, we've got to go backstage. And Vanessa's very down-to-earth and accessible and just, you know, that's the kind of thing she would do. So let's go see this workshop together. Mm-hmm. And we went backstage and gave Al a hug and thanked him for his amazing work in that. And I later saw rehearsals of this and then saw, you know, of course, the film, which you've probably seen. Have you seen it?
Yes. Yes, I just picked it up. I was so relieved because I've heard about it for so many years. And as a big fan, I just couldn't wait to get my hands on it.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. And you know, it hasn't been released until now, as you know. But
right.
Anyway, a few years later, I found myself cast opposite him in Cruising and went to meet him for the second time backstage at Richard III, which he was doing on Broadway. Little did I know I'd be in Looking for Richard, you know, a few years later.
Right.
I was quite sure he would want to rehearse. We were playing alter egos in this film, Cruising. As you know, he was the cop and I was the killer. And the way it was originally written, and which really intrigued all of us, you kind of knew who the killer was from the beginning, and you knew the cop and the killer, and you watched them come together. At some point, a decision was made to make it more of a murder mystery, and a lot of the stuff where you see the killer at the beginning... hit the the cutting room floor, actually, where they were looking for it.
Yeah, I
wildly lately because they were coming out with a DVD and they couldn't find it. Something happened when it was, I guess, went from Lorimar to Warner Brothers or whatever, and they were not preserving films so carefully in those days, and nobody could find it. But there were all sorts of footage of me and Al. That scene on the park bench went on much, much longer. It was almost like a little Pinter play in and of itself. I mean, we talked about black holes and outer space and all sorts of stuff. It was probably three times the length that's in the movie. And there were other scenes of me with William Russ at the beginning talking about my parents and my favorite films being The Third Man and Strangers on the Train and all sorts of things that kind of gave you a little bit of a hint of his inner psyche. But none of that, no one knows where that stuff is now. But anyway, I was sure that Al would want to work on the material, to rehearse the big confrontation scene, and to my amazement, he wanted to hang out, but he didn't want to rehearse. It was interesting. He, you know, we were bound together in this movie in a way, you know, we were nemeses of each other, but there was a deep connection in a way. And
right.
He wanted to, also probably knowing that I was a young actor, wanted to just get close and get me to be as relaxed with working with him as possible. So we hung out a lot, and we there were scenes that we weren't necessarily in, or that we were in the same space, but we didn't, you know, have dialogue together like in the clubs, you know, the
mm-hmm.
some of the leather clubs. And we would walk home together from this you know, kind of disorienting experience. Neither of us had ever been in a situation like that. And Friedkin was wanted to simulate very little. He wanted to actually go, you know, to be happening in these bars. So it was quite a summer of, whew, you know, wow.
I bet at that time, too.
What did we just live through here? And as you know, there were protests. There was some rioting in the streets of Greenwich Village. There were gay groups that didn't want the movie to be made and gay groups that thought it was an important movie to be made, a cautionary tale. And there was a lot of security issues, and we would leave these shoots and walk all the way uptown together and just talk and decompress. And we got very, very close, and we didn't rehearse that scene, you know, at all, but we were quite ready to shoot it when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was tremendously generous, very, very supportive. I mean, when you're working with Al, it's about the artistry, it's about the process. He loves the work, and he wants to bring out the best in anybody he's working with. I'll never forget, there was a night during that scene when we end up in the tunnel, you know?
Yes.
Where he was released because of a turnaround, and he said, I'll be damned if I'm not going to be there for your close-up. So he was off camera, staying on his own time.
Mm.
It was cold. It was, you know, 4 a.m. There were mosquitoes. And he was just there to be off camera for me.
That's very rare, and I've heard from other actors that he does that for them too. And that's
this blew my mind. He's off camera, and there's a weird moment where we're sort of, you don't know whether they're gonna you know, kill each other or fuck or what's gonna happen.
Right.
He has his pants off at one point with his leather jacket on. And he said to me, it's a weird image. I'm just going to take the pants off for you. So he was standing there in his boxers with his leather jacket. He's off camera. He doesn't have to do any of this. But it's a weird, you know, image that he thought might, you know, do something, you know, to me. And he just, it was for me being on camera. And he was released. I will never forget that. I mean,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's the kind of guy he is.
Yeah, I mean, we're very excited. You mentioned Richard III earlier. We have Thomas Waits, who was in that production of Richard III this Sunday night.
Oh, wow.
Speaking of some of that stage experience of Pacino's. But you also worked, I want to get into looking for Richard in Salamaybe.
He called me up and said, Richard, would you meet me at this cafe down in the village? Because we stayed in touch after cruising. It was like climbing a mountain.
Right.
Yeah, to go through that. And we'd read plays together sometimes. He loves to sit around and read plays, and he had this theater loft, he called it, on Broadway and around 20th Street, and we would read various things there. And one day he called up and he said, I want to talk to you about a project. Meet me at this cafe. I said, sure. And lo and behold, there was a cameraman there. This is Richard Leacock. And he filmed some of our conversation down there. I think there was one other person there. But that was the beginning of this amazing odyssey that took years and years and years. And years later, after we did a lot of the principal photography, called him and said, we've got Spacey's coming over, and Aidan Quinn, is coming over from London or something. We're going to get to shoot the Battle of Bosworth out in Simi Valley. it took a long time, but it was an adventure, as is Salamaybe. And in both cases, if you're really interested in Pacino's process, these are chronicles of his creative process, those films. It's quite extraordinary.
This new box set is probably, for a big Pacino fan like myself, it's probably the most revealing insight into who he is as an artist that we've ever had,
right?
These films. How is Pacino as a director? I know he said that he doesn't necessarily consider himself a director, but how is his process as a director?
Well, he leaves you alone a lot, and he wants to see what you bring to it, and then he may say a few things that are stimulating, and try this or that, but he's very. Very interested in your instincts and very, very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
He loves to rehearse. We rehearsed something in Salamaybe. He got an idea that he wanted to explore scenes suggested by David Hare's play, Judas Kiss, about the hours before Oscar Wilde was arrested. And
right.
I don't know how much of it will make it into the film, but we shot about 14 pages of it. We rehearsed it for a week. He would rehearse, by the way, after cruising. He did American Buffalo for years, on and off, in different places all over the world.
Yes.
He loves the theater. He does workshops of things. I mean, I remember going to watch workshops of Brecht's Jungle of Cities and Arturo Uy. I think he worked on Arturo Uy for 6 months and just did one public performance of it.
I know just a couple of years ago he did a performance of it.
He did another production of Arturo Uy,
right,
that Simon McBurney directed. But he did back, 20, 25 years ago, he explored Arturo Uy at the Public Theater for 6 months, I believe it was, with actors. Just working in the way that, you may know something about Andre Gregory and how he would work for a year at a time, like on Alice in Wonderland. When he was doing American Buffalo, I visited him in London when he was working on that, and I saw it many times in New York and at Long Wharf and other places. They would rehearse. Even after they'd worked on this play, after it had been in performance for a year or two, they would get together at 6 o'clock at night, and they would have a cup of coffee together. Sometimes they'd just talk about the day, but other times they'd say, at the end of Act One, I'm sure I once knew why I left, but so I want to just think about that again, and they'd talk and they'd stimulate each other, and.
Yeah.
I remember J.J. Johnson, running out of this rehearsal saying, God, I found something. I just found something new. This is after they've been performing for a year and a half.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I was so moved by this. I would go down and just sit in the back and watch what they would do. Some nights, as I said, it was just a cup of coffee just to make contact with each other. But other nights, it would evolve into real rehearsals. And I was about to work with Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronyn on Foxfire, and I asked them if we could get together ahead of time, and Hume looked at me like I was nuts. I said, Laddie, he said, we're old folks, we have our own rituals, and we take a nap and this and that, but if you have the chutzpah to ask us to come in early, he said, what the hell, maybe one night a week we'll do that. And I always felt that the performance was somehow richer that night that we'd come early.
Right. Well, you know, these endless rehearsals and these endless kind of, well, not endless, but these multiple takes that he requests, they really pay off, because in every Pacino performance, there it is filled with such surprising moments.
Absolutely.
That I know he found in that process.
He loves to mix it up and to try different things. And I remember hearing a story about Frankie and Johnny that or Michelle Pfeiffer, who, like Olivier and certain other actors, comes, you know, apparently with an orchestrated performance to the
mm-hmm.
set.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they may be very talented, but they come with an idea of exactly the moments they want to. Yeah, and Al would try different things on each take. And somebody said that Michelle Pfeiffer would turn to the director and say, "Look what he's doing. Can he do that?" I mean, director said, Gary Marshall said, "Well, yeah, he's doing it. Just go with it." And I don't know. I didn't see these takes, but a friend of mine was working on post production on Heat and mm-hmm. said that that it was very interesting to see the outtakes that De Niro would, according to this person, improvise a lot maybe in rehearsal, but once it got to performance, he would be fairly precise, because he wanted to make sure that certain things got on camera.
Yeah.
Whereas Pacino would be very different from take to take, and he'd sing one take, you know, in some odd way in the middle of, and then another way he'd be down, and then he'd be up, and on another take, and he likes to try it a lot of different ways.
Oh, what I wouldn't give to see those outtakes!
Yeah.
We have five actors from Salamaybe actually on Sunday. What can you, is it structured like Looking for Richard? What can you tell us about it?
A little, yeah. It's it springs from the play, from his interest in the play which he saw in London. Who was that great actor that did it in London? Berghoff.
Stephen Berghoff.
Stephen Berghoff did a version that he saw in London that turned him onto the play, I believe, and he then kept reading it and working on it himself. He did it with Marissa Tomei, as I think you probably
yeah.
know, in New York, and
Cheryl Lee. And
yes, right. And he wanted to do it out here, and he wanted to see if it could evolve into a film. And I think in the process of working on it, it became an adventure, like Looking for Richard is, you know, about his passion for Shakespeare and his trying to figure out a way to do it. It's a bit like that, in that you see them working on this on the stage performance. You see some of the stage performance. You see them trying to figure out a way to do it as film, and then some of it on film. But it's really about the effort. It's about the process to see what can I do with this extraordinary material. How can I make this accessible to people? And it's a wonderful, wonderful adventure. He goes, as he did with Looking for Richard, you know, he went to where they were building the Globe Theater there and whatnot. I mean, he goes to the room that Oscar Wilde died in, and he ruminates about Wilde's life and what he was all about. It's his love of Oscar Wilde as well as the play.
Right.
And it's the love of creative process, you know.
Personally, I can't wait for it. I personally think that Looking for Richard, I've told you in email, I think it's one of the most stunning movies in his resume.
Wow.
So I can't wait for Salamaybe. But as from an actor's point of view, is there a delineation between when you're performing Shakespeare on the stage and when you're bringing it to screen for a scene in the film?
Well, you mean in terms of the size?
And yeah, in terms of how it is played.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I had dinner once with Pacino and Vanessa Redgrave, and she was talking about the Rose Theater, I think it was, the Swan. Okay. And the Rose were the theaters prior to the Old Globe. They were much, much smaller, and they were very intimate. And you did all this declamatory, large, you know, Shakespearean souls came in later, you know, pretty much in the 19th century, you know, in the bigger houses. And of course, the Globe was a lot bigger than the Swan and the Rose. But you can. It's wonderful when you can be very intimate with this on film. And as you remember, looking for Richard, he's at one point almost whispering to himself, "A horse, my kingdom for a horse." You know,
yeah,
he's bellowing. So that's what's wonderful about the intimacy of film. I think Shakespeare lends itself beautifully to film for that reason.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate having you on, and you just have a fantastic resume. And I just, it's been an honor to speak with you. What's coming up next for you, other than Salamaybe?
Oh, got a few irons in the fire. I mean, I went to New York to do an interesting film that Emily Hubley directed called The Toe Tactic. You never know how much of what you did, you know, ends up in the film. I did a very funny scene in Henry Jaglom's Hollywood Dreams that did not end up in the film, that he was lamenting about the other day. I just couldn't find a way to, you know, tonally to use it, but I'm dying to see that that footage. You know, I've got a few things floating around, and a few people that had wanted me to do things like, you know, Milch had talked to me about Deadwood, but then that was canceled. You want to work with great people like Milch and Pacino, and that's what the joy is. And I had a good time in this thing I just did in New York. But you know, give me a holler sometime if you want to talk about anything else. And by then I'll probably be working on something else.
We'll definitely do that.
Thank you so much.
It's always a great pleasure to talk about him and his process, because it's exhilarating working with him. And I wish we could see all the things that he didn't quite get to do, like Hickey, you know, and Modigliani and some of
that. That's right.
Oh, did there's it. A laundry list of things. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Fascinating stuff.
You know, but keep your eyes peeled for the box set. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank
Take
you.
Take care, you guys. Okay.
Take care. Bye bye.